What is something that people experience or taste when they drink South African wine?
Sunshine in a bottle.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Role Models Podcast, a podcast where we interview successful and inspiring women about their personal journeys, career histories, and all the valuable lessons and learnings they've picked up along the way. My name is David Noel, and those of you who know me know that about 3 or 4 years ago, I developed an enthusiasm and interest in red wine. So today's conversation is a very special one for me for two reasons. First, it's a conversation about wine, and second, it's a conversation that I recorded in a wine region of Western Cape in South Africa, where I met one of South Africa's leading winemakers, Riani Strydom. Riani has won several prestigious international wine competitions and awards as a winemaker, and she has played an important role to put South African wines onto the world stage. I spoke to Riani at a very exciting time of the year because she was getting ready to see this year's harvest of grapes. And with all this excitement and potential so close on the horizon, it was a perfect time to pause and to look backwards and forwards at her many career achievements. Today's chat with Riani touches on a bunch of different topics, like, for example, the practicalities of marketing yourself and your product, and about why honesty and loyalty are two values that drive Riani's business decisions, and how to choose and decide the right career path for you, and why being friendly, goal-oriented, and showing enthusiasm are the key foundational skills that she recommends everybody to acquire. If you're interested in knowing more about wine, Riani has also some great tips on how to experience and enjoy wine without the feeling of being overwhelmed by all the educational and technical sides of the industry. One final thing that I want to mention is that you will hear some background noise, and that's because Riani and I recorded this episode literally in the middle of the cellar, the wine cellar. And you will be able to hear some of the barrels being moved around at some points. And that's just the hazards of podcasting so close where the action is. Shout out to our patrons for this episode. First, we have Megan Quinn, general partner at Spark Capital, and of course, previously a guest on his podcast. Megan supports the organization Code2040.org, and Anna Carolina, who is a leadership coach based out of Berlin, that you can find on truthcircles.com. They both support this episode with $10 per episode, and we appreciate this support a lot. Shout out also to a series of new patrons who joined us on Patreon, like Emma and Alexandra, who became patrons of the podcast since the last episode. If you want to join Anna, Megan, Emma, Alexandra, and many others in supporting the creation of this podcast, you can do this by visiting patreon.com/role models and become a patron of the podcast. As always, it means a lot to us when our listeners take a moment to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Doing so helps us navigate through the algorithms of the Apple Podcast iTunes store, and it helps reach more people like yourself. This is the Role Models Podcast. Thank you for listening. My name is David, and please enjoy today's episode with Riani Strydom. Riani, welcome to the podcast. We are here in, we're sitting here in a cellar of the vineyards that you manage, and where you're also the winemaker, where the wine estate is tucked into this beautiful vineyard to take about 2 kilometers from the main road to get here. It's a beautiful day in South Africa, not far from Stellenbosch, one of the regions, or maybe the region in South Africa that is known for its excellent wines, and you're a winemaker here at Haskell Wines, have been making wines for, what is it, 25 years?
Yeah, I think my career has been stretching over 25 years as a winemaker, from where I started, where I'm here, and Haskell Vineyards, I started in
2005.
So the first official wine was made from the 2005 vintage. The cellar was built in 2004.
That's great. Well, thank you for taking the time and welcoming me in the vineyards here. It's quite an unusual setting for a podcast, which we usually do via Skype interviews or in office buildings. So that's quite of a premium setting that we have here. Thanks for taking the time also. I know you have a busy day. Riani, I would love to jump into our conversation by asking you. So, you know, I have spent some time here in Cape Town, and the time we're recording this right now, the Cape region is going through a severe drought, and it just turned into 2018. So we're recording this in the end of January, and I was wondering, like, what is something, leaving aside the issue of the severe drought, which has a direct impact on your business as well, but what is something that you're most excited about in 2018?
Well, given the drought that we've been having, that's been coming over three seasons, I just think that the last, you know, winter, passing the last winter, after winter, the dams were at 30%, where at least the previous year we were still at 60%. So this is the first time that something like this, anybody is experiencing it. The positive of it is that the berries are quite small. And, you know, as my husband actually mentioned earlier today, I'd rather make 30% less, but 30% better quality. And that's basically, I think, what we're going in for this year. And if you look officially over the last three vintages, meaning 15, 16, and 17, if you know, 15 is one of those vintages of, you know, like, rated as one of our best vintages in many, many years. And 17 is looking to go in almost the same direction. And this is two vintages where we did have a stronger drought factor than maybe 16 that was in the middle of the two. And the wines that came out of there, they're legendary. So, you know, sitting here almost at the eve of starting to harvest, because we'll pick our first grapes next week, which is last couple of days of January, beginning Feb. I'm quite excited, yeah. And at this point, vineyard, when I think this is becoming a bit of a cliche probably at the moment, vineyard is seen as a weed and it can handle quite a lot of dry circumstances. Obviously, being where we are, you have water, so you give supplementary irrigation, but it's if you can start weaning off your vines, I'm sure we can get on with not having any water. The previous farm that I worked at for a very long time didn't have water at all. So all the years I harvested there, we never, ever had water. So this whole stressing about, are we going to have enough water for the season? It's like, we shouldn't even have that stress. Our vineyard should have been without water
keeping,
from the start. Yeah.
Keeping my fingers crossed that the 2018 yeah. vintage will be great. Riani, you're also one of the two, doing my research, I found that you're one of the two women who are part of a group of about 50 members of the Cape Winemakers Guild. So it's about, next to Andrea Moulineux, who's also a winemaker here in the region. You're one of those two members. Can you talk a little bit about what the Cape Winemakers Guild is and how you get, it's an invite-only organization, so how you get in there and why are there so few women?
So the Cape Winemakers Guild is an organization that's been running, I think we're in our 36th year this year. And it was established, obviously, that many years ago as, you know, as a group of guys and a woman. I think Norma Ratcliffe or Billy Hofmeyer's daughter was part of it, to kind of share knowledge. So it was a serious wine group that started, and that grew into where we are now today. The Cape Winemakers Guild, as you mentioned, we are invited to become members based on what you've achieved. So many people see us as the best winemakers in South Africa, and a lot of young winemakers, they aspire to become a Cape Winemakers Guild member. Why there's only two ladies, I can't say. Maybe the ratio for women versus men winemakers in South Africa is reflecting of it. I do think that has changed quite a bit over the last 10 years. You know, I'm in this for 25 years, and 25 years ago, I was probably one of 10 girls making wine compared to how many guys. So I do think it's something that's going to change. I mean, we nominate winemakers yearly I've nominated a girl last year. Unfortunately, she didn't come in, but it's there's a lot of guys that feel like me that we want to have more ladies on it, and we are going to pick them out. There is very successful winemakers in South Africa. For me, it's not you're man and you're woman. It's about how good is your skills and what do you stand for and how do you make the whole organization a better organization, because ultimately that's what we all, everybody that's a member of the Cape Winemakers Guild, want to make it a better organization than what it is, for what we stand for. And we have a strong program the education part's already done by that stage, but young winemakers that come into the system that we basically take under our wing for the 3-year period, that they work in cellars and gain much more experience. So by the time after Elsenburg or after university, they've got another 3 years practical experience in the industry, they can basically stand on their own and become really good assistants to somebody, or even those that have the confidence to start their own brand.
So you mentioned that the members of the Cape Winemakers Guild are those winemakers considered to be the best in the country, and are known to be part of that for being successful winemakers. If we go back 25 years to you were mentioning that you were one of 10 young women making wines, what compelled you to go into winemaking?
I was that's probably why I asked you the question about the 14 before. Yeah, 14 year. I actually decided I'm going to become a winemaker when I was 14.
Oh, okay. Great.
So,
and for listeners, back, we'll get to the 14, the question about 14 years.
Yeah. Why did I go into this? Well, I've always been a bit more of a off the beaten track person. I love challenges. I don't think at 14 I realized what winemaking really is. It was a picture in my mind. It was like, I think I like science and chemistry, and you know, you see this things bubble on the one side and all the cylinders and always look so impressive. This was the one side, and the other side was like driving in the vineyards or sitting on a horse and running, you know, all this like the fantasy side of it. And those were the two things that was the things that kind of intrigued me the most at that age of my life. And putting it together, winemaking came up. And I've just stuck to it. I've just always, we have our 30-year school reunion this year. And if I speak to some of my friends from those times, they just said, you were always just so focused and determined, that's what you're going to do. They just knew.
So when you said that you decided to go into winemaking or learn how to make wine at the age of 14, by that time, you were underage in terms of drinking age. Had you tried a wine by that time?
I was not so familiar with wine. My parents were in those days there was wine in the house, but it's not like my parents has never been. And I mean, I think my husband and I are still even not like that. You come at home every night and you open a bottle of wine and you drink. My parents has never been like that. It was always on occasion when alcohol was consumed, which was mostly wine anyway. It was literally a picture in my mind, and from there on, we did our research and where does it go? And it is so much more than just that. It's so much more than just getting a degree to become a winemaker. There's so many different facets around this, and it's very exciting, and it's to this day exciting for me still.
Yeah, it's almost like it's becoming even more exciting.
The more exciting exactly. It actually becomes. Yeah. Exactly.
So take us a little bit through the time. I guess we won't have time to stop it every year along the way, but maybe if you could take us through some of the major milestones in that career, and maybe stop at those where you feel like you went through a pivotal time in terms of learning, or maybe something that you realized, or maybe a failure. Or so, when you look back on 25 years of making wines, like what are some of the milestones that stick with you?
I always say to people, I've been so fortunate in my career. I've never really had hardships. I decided, obviously, very young what I wanted to do. I was always very determined. My dad did his research and realized that the one of the guys that was one of his roommates when he was at Varsity was actually head of the wine department at Nietvoorbij, which is a research institute here for wine. And he heard from him what I had to study to do what I want to do. So, you know, straight after school, one thing I actually, sorry, this is now a bit off the track, but this morning I realized, standing in the queue registering my son who's going to study wine now, that these things that we now go through as parents, what your marks need to be to do what degree, and, you know, do you have maths or do you have science or do you have... I didn't even realize that there were certain marks I had to achieve. I was just in school. I was fortunate to obviously do okay. I just walked straight into Varsity. And now if I think back and like, oh, what everything could have gone wrong if I didn't... And nobody really told me, listen, your grade 11 marks need to be pretty good. Otherwise, you're not going to get into Varsity and you're not going to... So I think my good fortune already started at a really young age. And I went to University of Stellenbosch, studied a BA Greek in viticulture and oenology, sat next to, you know, in a hall of probably 1,300 students studying agriculture. The girl that sat next to me was also studying it. And we were small classes. My class was 8 students, so it wasn't a big course that anybody studied. And to amongst 1,300 people sit next to another girl that's actually studying the same as you. That it's already another fortunate thing that happened.
Are you still in touch with her today?
Yeah. She's just not making wine anymore now. She actually heads up our integrated production of wine section, where, you know, we are, you kind of audit it according to what do you do in your cellar. So it's a very environmental thing, and it's, yeah, kind of above my intellectual level, and that's really good for her. But yeah, we're still good friends. Her son has also just finished school and so on. So milestones, you know, while I was studying, I decided, well, I can go become a waiter or I can go work on a wine farm and already be in touch with wine and kind of learn the consumer side of it. So I started working as a student at Morgunov. It was probably the first cellar if you leave Stellenbosch. It was close to get by, and I worked there 2001 while I was still studying. And by the time I finished my studies, they needed an assistant, so I was offered a job. So I, you know, don't have a CV still to this day, 25 years later. And then from there, I had a fantastic 10 years. I literally moved on from them at that stage because I wanted to start my own business and make my own wine. And also my oldest went to school the next year. So that's why I kind of resigned. And then just over the December holiday, Haskell Vineyards basically came up through a friend of a friend. And my husband was the winemaker next door at Tristan Frieda. And somebody also asked him the same time. So it was... To kind of come help them in the mornings, tell them what they need to do in the cellar. So he came home, he said, Briani, this proposition came up. It's a small winery. I know you don't want to be home for the kids, but you're going to be busy in the mornings. And then from the other side, somebody also came and said, Briani, you know, would you think you're going to have time? So it was coincidental that it's from two sides, the same thing came up. So I had to do it. You know, it's... I believe in things are put in your way. And from there onwards, I've been here now for the last 12 years. And it's a fantastic little spot in Stellenbosch on the Helderberg. We kind of in the center of the Golden Triangle. And
What's the Golden Triangle?
So the area that we are in on the Helderberg and this specific corner that we are, it's got like... the name of the Golden Triangle. So it's like kind of, we've got our own soil type, and quite special wines are made here. Really good for Shiraz, and it's us, next door to us is Stellenzicht, you get Waterford, if you go up the valley you get Kiermont, you get the Trafford, and it's seen as the Golden Triangle, obviously as you go in the valley and it makes a triangle. So it's just like a subdivision in a subdivision in a way, mm-hmm. that people kind of refer to us. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that's basically how my life has been running. I've not felt in any way, I know when I started working, there was a lot of ladies that kind of started a women in wine organization, and there was a lot of negativity in a way that, you know, we're not being seen as proper winemakers, or we don't get the good jobs or whatever. And I've just really been fortunate to be to have mentors and cellar masters, only actually one, that just he studied here and then he went to Germany and he studied there, and he was so much more open-minded about if you're a girl or a boy. It just didn't bother him. He just wanted you to do a good job. And invited me. He was a CWG member at that stage, short for Cape Winemakers Guild. And he had me involved at the CWG since I was a young student or a young winemaker. And eventually I became one. So it's kind of just all positive that started in my life. I don't feel any negativity that came my way to excel in my career, and I hope I've made the best of the opportunities that I've gotten.
So when I listen to you speak about or reflect on those years, it sounds like two moments really stand out. Is one, you choosing to go work as an assistant winemaker. And then the other is to accept the opportunity to take over the Haskell Vineyard and then turn this into what it is today. If you go back to the time as an assistant winemaker, is this how does this work? Like, how do you become, after you've studied, how do you become an assistant winemaker? What is the typical career path there? And was that a very competitive field, or was it something that you had to apply, or do you get recruited from winemakers or master winemakers or primary winemakers? How does that work?
So I would suggest any young person, after their studies, somewhere you need to do an internship. Today's young people are from a different generation than what we are, and they've got much more confidence and they've got much more knowledge because their access to knowledge is so much more. And I think today's young people seek more knowledge on a faster turnover than where I am. I mean, I'm still from the paper era, and I sometimes struggle with everything going so fast. But so I would suggest anybody that wants to be successful in life is to just sit back after your studies and just learn from people that's already been through it. You're going to make much less mistakes. You're going to be able to live out something that I hope whatever work you want to do, and really live it out. Because once you start becoming in a managerial position, what you really love doing becomes maybe 20% of your job. 80% becomes the admin, the managing people, the marketing, in my case now. Because winemaking is a really practical part of it. So, but if you're an assistant winemaker, that's what you do. You know, you're the guy up in the morning, 5 o'clock, picking the Sauvignon Blanc, and you're the one last end of the day helping the guys, cleaning the press, whatever. That's where you really, really learn. And that's where you establish where you want to go in life and what you want to achieve in wine and how part of it you want to be. I mean, there's many guys that is really good managers and that is really good with teaching other people how to do jobs. But you can't really teach somebody if you haven't really been part of it yourself, and if it doesn't come from in yourself to teach somebody else to the next step. You can't be a selfish person and think that you're always going to do everything yourself, and somewhere you have to leave a legacy with somebody else. So I would suggest any young person to do that. So the normal path, as you asked, the normal path would be you finish your studies and then you apply for a job at Sellers, that is advertising. In my days, there was a really good balance. As I said, we were 8 students in class, and we were basically seen as a big class because normally there was 4 or 5. So the industry was very balanced. So if you basically finished varsity or at Elsenburg, which was 10 students at that days, you basically walked into a job as an assistant. You learn. If you had the confidence to want to start your own brand, or maybe your father have a cellar, you would then learn from your father or your mother or however you see it.
Mm-hmm. So there was a small pool of talent every year going into the wine industry.
Of graduates.
Taking on assistant winemaking duties. How is that today? How is that ratio today? Is it?
I think there's much larger? More. Yeah, your amount of people graduating now at Elsenburg is about between 10 and 20 because they've enlarged the cellar technology class. And at University of Stellenbosch, you know, there's been years that there's been 60 students graduating as winemakers. And there's not, you know, so the balance is a bit different now. So I do think, and one of those classes specifically has been a very, very strong, academically strong class and strong winemakers. And they are, you can see how they grow in our industry today. They are really, really doing well and excelling. And they all have found good jobs. This year, where I'm, because I'm looking for an assistant at the moment as in a supporting role for me in the cellar and somebody I can be a mentor for, I can't find any. So they've all found jobs. So the industry has kind of rectified himself or herself again with the amount of people retiring. You know, on the other side, if you're a winemaker, why would you want to retire? You know, you, it's something you can do for the rest of your life. Where the amount that come in, I mean, I'm really struggling finding an assistant or somebody that's basically just graduated just to start, you know, give them a stepping stone. They might not stay with me for long because it is good to move around and get to work with grapes from different areas, different systems, all of that. So my career path was, I'd never applied because I was at Morgunov working as a student in the tasting room. When I finished my studies, it changed ownership. It was a winemaker that was there for one season. So he asked me if I would want to stay to become his assistant winemaker. And I was assistant there for 5 years. And then he left. And then I became the cellar master after 5 years. Because by that stage, you know, I was basically running the whole cellar. I was not running the vineyards, but I was running the cellar. And it was a much bigger operation than what we have now. And there was a farm manager, and we went on. And I was there for another 5 years as the head winemaker. I had a couple of younger assistants, or one guy at a time. But I had an assistant, and I basically had two or three other cellar hands. That's how my operation worked.
So you mentioned the difference between running the vineyard and running the cellar. What's the difference there for people who are less aware of how it works?
Yes, I mean, you study viticulture or you study oenology, you specialize in one or the other. The only difference, and I'm talking now from the University of Stellenbosch, where I got a degree, the difference between it is not really your viticulture and oenology subjects. That is exactly the same. Doesn't matter which one you specialize in.
But viticulture is the
growing of the grapes.
The growing of the grapes.
Yes.
The,
oenology is the
agriculture
making
part of it.
Yes.
And then oenology is how to make the,
yes,
the wine. Okay, great.
Any good winemaker that works in a small winery setup like what we are, you need to have a strong knowledge of the vineyard. And actually, as small as we are, you don't even have to have a separate vineyard manager. The winemaker must actually manage the vineyards, and then from there it comes to the cellar. The work is three quarters done in the vineyard. So if you have done that correct, what you really want to achieve as a winemaker, expressing your terroir and your site, it's better to start there than just letting somebody else do that and you trying to make it in the cellar how you got in your mind. So in the operation where I am, it's a very strong strong knowledge of vineyard. The young viticulturist that I had, we appointed a young winemaker, and he had to work there for 2 years really before he literally came to start working for me in the cellar, so that he really understands, okay, I've got that flavors on the wine, and that is what I did in the vineyard. Next year, I don't really want so much of that. How can I change it there so that I could get this result here? It's really important in a small boutique cellar operation. A co-op is something different. But then a bigger operation will have viticulturist that does that full time, and there will be a really good connection between the viticulturist and the oenologist about what they want to achieve. So oenologist would actually tell the viticulturist, listen, I want this, this, and this, and they will manage the vineyard accordingly to achieve these results. You can imagine if you're a cellar that does 12,000 tons of grapes, you won't have the time to manage and get to all those vineyards, basically.
So how do you, when you have this distribution of responsibilities and also expertise, how do you then how does the interplay work between the person who manages the vineyard and then the seller? How do you create a good synergy between those two people to deliver and to eventually create really amazing wine?
Well, I think both of you need to, you can't, let me put it this way. In our career, maybe, people maybe disregarded viticulturists for a long time. Where now it's like the job people want to do, you know?
Because so looking after the grapes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's not just you're a farm manager, you don't have any qualifications. We have viticulturists that have serious qualifications. They travel the world, they can see what they do in other parts of the world to see what can we implement here to get rid of methoxypyrazine flavors in Cabernet Sauvignon for that matter, or how can I get more of it in Sauvignon Blanc because that's what people want to smell on. How can I make better Merlot than Saint-Emilion for that matter? You know, so no, it is something that is really on par and also very scientific. So there's not this disregard of you just the guy that's in the vineyard. That doesn't exist anymore because we as a country will not be able to go forward if we can't have synergy between those two. So, you know, what you've asked, you know, in my mind, you can't separate it. It needs to be that one person doing both, or you as two people need to be on exactly the same page. If the winemaker is the stronger one and the other person needs to be taught, then the one that needs to be taught must be open for discussion and see. And that person must do his research or her research and know, okay, if the winemaker has asked me this, and so I can do this, this, and this, and that's going to be the result. But it's not going to work if you want to make successful wine, if the viticulturist wants to follow their own mind, and then the winemaker had another picture in their mind, and then they can't understand, but why doesn't the wine come out the way I want it? And if you take it back, and that person didn't do what you ask, there is no fixes for wine in the cellar. Maybe if you're a big operation, you can blend to achieve a certain result. For a small operation like us that make 6,000 liters of this wine and 3,000 liters of that wine, there's no scope for making mistakes because there's no way of for me to rectify it for the volumes that I have.
So it sounds like you, in the case where those roles are handled by two different people, it sounds like the communication between those people is very, very important.
Yes.
How does that look like in a day to day? So do you meet every day, every week? Is there long term vision? Is there how does that work?
No. You work out a program, and your viticulturist, or even if you have an assistant winemaker. Talking about two jobs now in one sentence, you work out a program and they need to follow that program. It also learns a young person, one day they'll be in a position where you are, how to structure that to achieve a result. Sometimes you don't realize how much effort go in the planning to be successful. You know, especially if you're a young winemaker, you just want to make wine. It's like, but the logistics behind it is actually the biggest trick. Once you get the logistics right, the rest becomes easy. But if you can't manage the logistics, it's not going to happen. But so communication is key. You can have, you know, I can drive through the vineyard on a Monday morning or a Thursday morning or a Friday morning, and you put your work plan together for the next week, and they need to follow according to that work plan. There's certain times, like at the moment, our vintage are a bit late, and the Merlots are almost complete with veraison, which is the colouring of the grapes. But it's time now to walk through the vineyard and throw off all the green bunches. So there's very specific things that happen specific times in a vineyard, and it just needs to follow through and be
so
done.
So it needs to pursue like a tight operation.
Yes, I think you need, if you want to be successful in any business, it needs to be a tight business. And having the size we have now, there's a lot of room for playing around and experimenting on a day-to-day basis in the cellar, in harvest, even in the vineyard before the time. You know, if there's only a small section of a block, and our blocks aren't big, we don't harvest much, but there's a small section in the vineyard that you want to do maybe a different pruning method. It's easy for me in the cellar to keep that separate and fermented in one barrel. and then eventually compare that barrel to the 5 tons that I'm fermenting in another tank. Because I've got facilities to do that. We're harvesting 70 tons of grapes in total. I mean, I'm not a 700-ton cellar. So there's always room for experimentation. And it's good to experiment because it keeps your mind kind of innovative all the time. It's exciting. If you bring out something that's hugely successful, it can go through your whole brand and it puts you in a different perspective with stuff.
So there's one thing that I would love to jump back to because we talked about it a few minutes ago, and you mentioned that the advice that you would give young people who come into the business really to absorb or to take on every task that is available that comes up, because that's the right way to learn. If you would share advice on what young, emerging, upcoming winemakers should spend most of their focus on, most of the energy, or where do you see, asked differently, where do you see people not wasting energy or wasting time, but maybe there's a false approach or a misallocation of energy and time. Like, what would you suggest people to focus most of the effort on?
If you're a young winemaker, yeah, just starting out,
yeah,
I think you need to get in the vineyard. I think you need to have a spade and you need to dig holes and see what your soil looks like.
Ah, that's great. Why the vineyard? Why the soil? Now we're getting to the weeds of the making the wine, the terroir, etc.
Exactly.
So that's a good.
So if you want to be a winemaker, I think in a small estate, and you see, I kind of hammering on the small producers and stuff. Cause there's really very very successful big wineries that is not cooperatives in South Africa as well. But in the end, our vines are planted in soil. Soil has developed over the last millions of years. You can, with one action, doing soil preparation in order to plant a new vineyard, completely stuff it up that you never in your life will be able to plant vineyard there again. So it is so crucial that you have a good knowledge of what are you actually starting to work with. And then from there, it goes. So what's underneath? So once you have a good idea of what's going underneath, you can make a much better decision of what do I plant on top that's going to give me the best possible offering, not what I want, but what does that soil want to give me? Because once you've done that, you've probably done 80% of making a world-class wine. It starts down there. So a young person that comes here and that's got a degree or a diploma in a BA Greek degree in wine technology, and they come here and they tell me they don't want to know what goes on in the vineyard, that's not going to work. Not. Then you need to go and work in a place where you're in charge of a bunch of people and you write down little notes because you're just making scientific wine. I'm not a scientific winemaker. I'm a winemaker that needs to feel right. I need to walk in my vineyards, look at the analysis because this pH is this and TA is this and da-da-da. But what does the grapes really look like? Are they ready to be picked?
What is that feeling you're looking for or that you're experiencing when you walk through the vineyard?
So if you come in your vineyard enough, you have an idea what is the block synergy? You know, what does it give you? So especially getting close to ripening time, as I said, you can just pick on analysis or you can go and see, okay, you know what? The leaves are still green. There's not yellow leaves. There's no stress. The sugar is maybe saying it's now ripe to pick, or my pH has really dropped, but can I maybe just go that little bit more just to make that difference between making an ordinary wine and that like mind-blowing wine? And that's the kind of things that I go. So I would taste the berries. I'm sorry about that. I'll taste the berries, look at the pips, look at the bunches. Are they starting to kind of naturally throw the fruit off? Because grapes is like any fruit, that's your way of regenerating. So does the bunches start going brown along the edges that they would have naturally made more grapes? You know, is the leaves falling? All of those things. You know, that's the stuff that you're only going to get once you get into the vineyard.
So it sounds like you introduce that as a feeling, but it sounds like a deep analysis that you're going through by walking through the vineyards, by touching things, by testing them out. And then the aggregate of all of this analysis p- paired with that feeling gives you that feeling, yeah, like, okay, now's the right
time. It's a natural analysis of something. You know, it is still a fruit, and the fruit will decide when it's ready to really fall off. Unfortunately, in South Africa, we've got a lot of heat, so our analysis go a bit weird, because our sugars, because we have so much sunshine, can go very, very high. And with high sugars, you get, obviously, pHs go up, your TAs go down. Where if you're in Europe, and I'm specifically only referring to France here, you know, yes, and there's climate change has also played a major role. But a couple of years ago, you know, you would, this is how we pick grapes. You would walk in the vineyard of Merlot, for that matter. You will kick on the vine, and once the berries just naturally fall off, it's ready to pick. Because now the fruit was ready to come off by itself naturally. So that is the best point of phenolic ripeness that berry gives you in order to reproduce. And now, that is the best time that you should pick that berry if you want to make the best wine out of it.
So terroir is a term that if you're knowledgeable with wine as a wine drinker or a consumer, is something that you become familiar with. For people who are not familiar with that, so to me it sounds like it's this combination of the grapes, the variety of the grapes, it's the weather, it's the wind, it's the sun, it's the angle of the sun, it's the it's all of it, it's the water. It's a combination of all of that. Can you expand a little bit on that and how to think about terroir for people who are not aware of what it's like? And then also maybe the linkage to what then people experience in the glass when they taste the wine.
So terroir is, in this whole equation of the industry that I am in, terroir is a given that you cannot change. That is what our Mother Earth has given us. You decided to buy a farm there. But you can't put the terroir of your neighbor's farm on your farm. That is your terroir. So that is kind of the thing that is not changeable in a natural way. You as a human can maybe mess it up. But the earth have given you that. And especially if you can maybe have virgin land, that is great. Virgin land means that no kind of fruit tree or something, it's standing there with what we have, fynbos for that matter, in South Africa, and you cleaning it up and you see, wow, you've got this fantastic high clay Glen Rosa soil available, and now you start doing your soil analysis and stuff, and then you decide, you know, with recommendations, what will be the best grapes to plant there. So I can't really expand on what terroir is. Terroir is maybe not the grapes that you plant there, because that's what you're going to add there. But the terroir is exactly as you say. The soil is there. There's a microclimate. There's a gradient towards the sun. You're north-facing or you're south-facing. You're going to have southeasterly winds, or you're going to have north-facing north winds. You may be higher up in the mountains. You might have the effect of mist, so it's going to be slightly cooler than down in the valley. Those things, it's things nature gives you. You cannot change that. You can only make the best possible decision of what needs to be planted through this research that's been done over many, many years, that's going to make the best possible decision, planting-wise, grape-wise, in our case, to make that best bottle of wine.
When you were brought the opportunity to take over this estate or this vineyard here, how you went through this entire analysis as you described it, but Was there another vineyard competing with that? Were you exploring, or did you say, here's an opportunity, I made my analysis, the soils are great, we just get going here? Or do you go and compare to other places in the lands and
The previous farm I came from was on the Simonsberg, and where we are now it's known as the Helderberg. So each of those sub-regions kind of have their own little terroir and which grapes does best. So when I came to this property, it was a young property, in the sense new owner, but wasn't really farmed as a grape farm or wine produced in the past. It was, again, coming back to the fortune that I've had, fortunate kind of decisions that's come along my road in my career path. I had this idea for almost a 2 or 3 year period at the end of Morgenhof as well, that I would like to run a property from scratch to something. And from scratch meaning even the gardens need to be developed. And that's exactly what this was. You know, as I said, and then people from two different angles approached me, one my husband, this is going to come up, you know, do you think you'll be interested? And I'm here 12 years later. So it's obviously was a huge interest for me. When I came here, I still have this one vineyard. There's only one vineyard, white vineyard on the property that was planted in 1988. The other vineyards was planted in, 60% of the farm was planted in 1999. And the others were planted in 2002. So we only have 13 hectares of vineyard. The vineyards that was planted in 2002, with all of this analysis that was done through a company, Vimpro, suggestions, they at that stage have already analyzed the soil. All of that was already done. So I did not do all of that. I basically came when those vineyards, for the first time, came into production, so which was very exciting. 40% of the farm in 2005 produced their first grapes. The vineyards that was planted in 99 basically were in their six-year production. And normally in the life cycle of vineyard, you basically give it the first 5 years to come in its full production. So it was really starting something from, I've no history. I didn't have to inherit another winemaker's wine that I first have to sell out and then start to express what this terroir is giving us. It's the way I think not all winemakers maybe express their terroir. Some of them want to express their personality. So that's just the way I think about it. So we have taken out some of the vineyard since I've been here because all my vineyards are north-facing and had a vineyard of Sauvignon Blanc. And in South Africa, Sauvignon Blanc is a cool climate grape. So if you're going to plant Sauvignon Blanc in Stellenbosch, you want to have a southwesterly slope. That you can have the effect of the cool sea breezes, or you have to go and plant it in the cool areas. So here, being such a small farm, having Sauvignon on north-facing, if you're small like us, you need to make wines that makes an impression. So we took those out. There was a vineyard of Shiraz, and we a great area for Shiraz, but the Shiraz, being 6 years old, we're already starting to show a virus. Phylloxera, you know, with the red leaves. Such a small farm, if you want to, you know, make it work, you need to have all the vines in full production. So we took it out after 6 years and we've replanted it. So we made crucial decisions right in the beginning, and that maybe comes to what you've asked me, you know, with those decisions. We did that from the start. I worked with the guys in the vineyard every day. There was a lot of mishandling of vines where stuff were planted but they didn't go and take off the little plastic binding that they were held together in order to trellis them and little stuff like that. So we did a lot of work on the vineyards in the first 4 or 5 years after I've come here, and now we are reaping the awards.
So that's about 12 years later, the awards of that. Yeah. So how talk a little bit about, because so what it sounds like is making wines is it starts with the passion of wanting to creating the wine. It's a lot around the connection to nature and the soil and the environment that's given to you, and then how you work with the vineyards over a long period of time to get to a wine, as you just described, you know, for a smaller property like you have, to make a wine of impression. So what is the, how does this work in a world that is distracted, that thinks short term, that wants to see the rewards right away, perhaps even thinking about quarterly results like the stock market, etc. Like, how do you, do you just have a different philosophy, or how does it work being a winemaker and have to think about the long term, but also having to produce a wine every year, and the world that's so fast moving and kind of looking at things to reap the rewards faster than the earth can maybe give you?
Yeah, it is. For me, as I said, being from the previous generation, it's a bit sad because, you know, my passion for wine is for the almost a generation before me where they had, you know, so much time and everybody had cellars and they obviously didn't have the equipment that we have today. So the way that they have to make, had to make wine, say for argument's sake, if you ferment grapes, you release energy and the energy is heat. So you really want to ferment between certain temperatures, and we all now have cooling. But if you think of 40 years ago, maybe, or 50 years ago, people didn't have equipment, technical equipment like we have today. So, you know, Grant, one of the partners here, he always tells a story, and some of the best wines in Australia, you know, they just chucked ice blocks in this fermenting stuff. So they were actually diluting everything the whole time, but the whole idea behind it was to cool down the wine. So the other way of making wine in those days was also you pumped over more, you know, with reds, your mark all goes to the top. So you need to kind of pump the wine from the bottom over the top to extract your pigments, your color, your taste and stuff. So you pumped over much more. And if you pump over much more, you have much more extraction of tannins. So therefore, you are making wines that you really only possibly can drink after 20 years, once the tannins are softened. So this was the wines from the previous era. Coming back to your question with today's young people and this fast gratification and stuff, I'm in a way still quite an old school winemaker, and tannins to me in reds are my preservatives instead of sulfur dioxide in a way. So we extract quite a lot, and my wines have to be at least 5 or 6 years old before they really are starting to taste that people get the point. And I'm fortunate that I can release my wines a bit older with the ownership that we have. But with the instant gratification, I do quite a strong part of the marketing in the overseas market. And last year at one of these events, I just realized that I'm telling everybody that I'm making wines for age, but nobody wants to hear that. We're living in a fast world. Nobody has space in their houses for cellars anymore. So they're not interested in a wine that they still need to cellar for 8 years before it's drinkable. They are interested in the wine that's, it's 2018 and 2016 is fine. As long as it's bottled and it's no bottled and it hasn't got much tannins and it's fruity, they want to go and buy it today in the supermarket and they want to drink it tonight. So I need to kind of adapt the way I'm selling my wine, because my wine is maybe not that young that I'm selling, but by the time I'm releasing a 2014 Shiraz, for that matter, under my second label, the wine is actually ready to drink. So I can't go and tell people, this has still got cellar potential, you still can cellar it for another 6 years. Today's generation is not interested in that. That I tell to the guys that's a couple of years older than me. They want to hear that because they are still interested in that style of wine. The young people, not really, because of space constraints. The success of achieving in shows instant gratification, I think there's a different winemakers that's going to look for instant gratification versus guys that realize what it's about. And if a wine is awarded a really big thing, it's awarded because it's seen as a classical style and something that's got potential to put away. I mean, us as a young wine-producing country want to compete in the international scene. I mean, to invest in wine is one of the best investments in the world that you can make at the moment.
Why is that?
The potential growth for per value, you know, and I'm now talking about your first growths, your iconic Burgundies, your Sauternes, your, you know, the top-end Rieslings. There's a great investment value in that. You know, you purchase en premier in France, or I don't know how they do it in Germany, but if those wines are 10-year-old, that potential percentage growth, in some cases, is almost bigger than on cars, you know, if you look at investment cars. So that is relative. And if we are going to make wines continuously in South Africa, and a big chunk of our wines are like that, that is just about instant gratification, we're never going to get the respect from the old world that we are making wines that can age 25 or 50 years for that matter.
So you, I think it's a good segue into the going from winemaking to drinking wine. And but before that, maybe a few words about you spending a lot of time also traveling the world to go and you know, other places and regions where great wines emerge, and to learn from that. And I think one of the things that I picked up that I really liked, because I enjoyed the region as well, Saint-Emilion. So I spent some time in the summers in the Bergerac region, which is like the little sister of the Bordeaux. Region. So when you fly into Bordeaux, you have to go through the Bordeaux region, and you can stop by Saint-Emilion on your way to Bergerac, etc. So when you think about your time that you spent in vintages in Burgundy or in Saint-Emilion, and then places like Australia, maybe even the US, other parts of South America, how do you, when you come back here, what is... Here, meaning back to South Africa, what is something that you take away from all of these different places and give it your own personal flavor or your personal touch here in your own vineyards?
You know, it's... this goes for any careers. You must never stop thinking that there's nothing for you to learn anymore. And traveling... You know, even if it's a marketing trip, or if I did find myself in the vineyards of a beautiful area of the world, there's always something that you can bring back. You can never do it exactly the same than what they do it there, but you can form an idea around it of they've achieved that, they've done that. What can I do here to have a similar result? And I'm going to have to try it. It might work or it might not work. But as long as you have that willingness to want to learn and want to try, I think you should pursue it. But the main thing is you should never think there's nothing to learn. Now, we are the bee's knees. Who are they to show me something? And that's the thing that I actually enjoy the most. I mean, even here, if we have Italian winemakers or whatever coming to South Africa and making world-class Merlot, for that matter, which is probably the grape that is, the besides Pinot Noir, the most difficult red to make. You know, to attend wine tastings like that, and they tell, okay, I've done this, whatever. I mean, my head immediately starts working. It's like, okay, you know what? I'm doing it already kind of halfway there, but maybe now it's time to step it up and do it 100% like that and just try. Try it on one tank. As I said, I've got a facility where I can make one barrel of something or 5 tons of something, and the possibilities are there. And it's always exciting. I always have a new thing that I want to try. You know, vineyard-wise, we you know, slowly but surely, it's more the viticulturists that's traveling a lot, and they are picking a lot of viticulture things. And they are implementing it here very interesting. I think for many, many years, we basically farmed our grapes in the same way, in its four-way trellis system, or its bush vine, and that was it. Now we're starting to farm with different, what's the English word? with different systems, how to train our vines, you know, where it's not just the four-wire system, and It's difficult to convince older farmers to look at possibilities, but the younger guys, coming back to that, the knowledge, they are more open for stuff. And they're more open of trying something, and if it doesn't work, just cull it, let's try the next thing until we find something that works. But knowledge is there, and we need to make use of it through travel, through internet, through talking to people, through contacts. Relationships, we need to use that.
So it sounds like that your travels across the world enabled you to connect with local winemakers, and then, you know, take the best parts that you learned there, and then to see if you can adapt them for your own surroundings. So it sounds to me that like the wine industry is an open industry where there's a lot of exchange and people, you know, prepared and willing to share knowledge and lessons learned. Why do you think that is, and how was the importance of mentors? You mentioned mentors earlier. How much of those trips or those mentors, those individuals, have influenced your career over time?
Every country is very different, and it is, you know, as you mentioned, there's a bit of an openness regarding knowledge. Every country is not that easy. South Africans share a lot. We're very open, you know, so the relationship amongst winemakers here is very open, viticulturalist. You know, if I see somebody's doing this and I would ask that person about it, they would be happy to share it. It's not the same in other parts of the world, but if we approach a winemaker from South Africa, or, you know, from a South African point of view, and we would approach a winemaker in France or probably the US, obviously some countries are easier than others, in the US, and say, listen, I'm coming to your country and I would like to come visit your cellar and whatever. And once you can get that direct contact, then the knowledge is open. Some of the guys is not going to be interested to see you. Other people are. But the people that are, having said that, I think 20 years ago to do this was definitely more difficult than it is now, because now you're also finding the younger generation winemakers, because a lot of the wineries overseas, remember, are kind of family old for the last how many years. So it goes from the father to the son, and that's how it goes, or the daughter for that matter. So the knowledge is much more shareable amongst the younger people. And we would approach a winemaker from here, organize a trip for 10 days, do 3 visits a day, and speak to the person that's really part of. And most of the people we go to, they take us to their vineyards, and then they take us to the cellar to taste wine. That is just the main way of thinking, obviously in the kind of people that we approach. And next time, they want to come visit South Africa. And now you've made a connection, and you do the same when they come here. So that's just, that is at the moment just how it works.
When you talk about, so you mentioned marketing being one purpose for those trips. Can you talk a little bit about marketing wines in the world? Because I think it's a fascinating area of marketing, right? As a discipline now, as something. So we know, you know, marketing for consumer goods, we know marketing for fashion, etc. So wine is an industry that's probably not the top choice for marketing professionals, but has such a great potential to share stories because of the terroir, because of the story of the wine, the vintage, the winemaker, the ability to really create a brand, you know, with the labels and the property and the estates. How do you, like, if you would have to pitch the wine industry or Haskell Vineyards as a great place for marketing professionals to come and help you out, how would you do that? What would you tell them?
Well, one element that definitely is quite appropriate in our operation is, because we're small, we're seen as a boutique winery, and it's maybe not something that I want to kind of do full-time, to be a marketing person. And in many ways, I still believe I'm definitely not the right marketing person, because a marketer thinks in a different way than a scientific-orientated person. But, you know, I can tell any young winemaker now, the sooner you learn how to present yourself and have confidence in yourself in order to sell your product, the faster you are going to sell your product. There's no time of you, that murmured winemaker sitting in the cellar, and you actually chose that career because you don't like talking to people or whatever. People want to speak to the winemaker. If you're a very large operation, there is 5 marketing people, and they go out there and they go find the business. But in the end, somewhere, that person that's buying your wine, they want to meet the person behind the wine. And in our case, as much as I sometimes don't like to do these trips, most of the time it takes me away from my family, I'm out of the country, my system is, you know, everything goes the other way around, and my work stays behind, I am the best person to market this wine. If it's an expensive bottle of wine, people want to be convinced, why should I buy this one and not that one that's 4 times less expensive? And people want to have the truth. I'm not going to lie, because I'm not marketing orientated. I don't have to spiel a story to make the sale. To me, it's just to see through me the passion that I try to put in the bottle to that person. And once the person can get that, they're going to be a follower forever. And that's basically what we try and do through the marketing, to find, you know, if somebody wants to come here and learn, not learn me more marketing skills, because it's not what I want to do full time, but if they want to come in here and kind of think the way I think, but then put their marketing brain on and take this brand to the next level, I think it would be first prize. And then I can just source the wine, and he can organize, or she can organize me where I need to be when, and I don't have to do all of that. That would be great.
So now it sounds like we have two jobs available at Haskell Vineyards.
Exactly.
One is an assistant winemaker for you to be a mentor to. Yeah. And then number two, there's a marketer who can come in.
Ex-food marketing manager, yeah.
So if you're listening to this and want to do a transition, career transition into winemaking or wine marketing, you know where to go now. I would love to talk to you a little bit about drinking wine. So I've been a... I'm really an experienced wine drinker, but I've jumped into wine a little bit more thoughtfully or consciously three or four years ago, and with a preference for red, strong, heavy, full-bodied, heavy reds. And so I think for people who are less experienced with wines, who see it more as a functional beverage, if I may call it that, it's a huge universe that might be overwhelming to people. How do you organize that universe to people who are like, teach me how to think about wine?
Meaning somebody that hasn't really drank wine before, or
yeah,
that is just interested?
Interested in it, who enjoys wine as a taste, as a beverage, but wants to learn a little bit more about it. And
yeah,
is a bit scared of this huge universe of different grapes, different vintages, different origins, and all of that.
The best in anything is to take everything step by step. And the, you know, the thing that maybe sitting on this side and having a knowledge of wine is to speak to people that think they know a lot about wine. With anything in life, as long as you, again, being open to learn something, you are going to probably learn the fastest. But if you have the attitude, it's like, nobody can teach me anything, you're not going to learn anything. One thing people need to know, you should not feel intimidated by wine. Don't feel, okay, but I'm not going to drink wine because so-and-so might ask me a question and then I'm not going to be able to answer it and then I'm going to feel like an idiot. That's not what we as winemakers want people to feel like. You know, it's, I do think maybe we as the winemakers, marketing, salespeople behind it sometimes try and educate people too much about wine, and that takes the enjoyment out of it. It's not always about learning something. Most of the time, is about living life and having the best enjoyment possible time out of something. So, but if you really want to learn about wine, and you know a winemaker friend, then ask your friend to speak to you at the level that you understand something. Don't come with pH and TA and technical stuff. Tell the person, if I refer to pH, it would refer to this or this or this, and this is the effect. But explain wine. Like, I had a friend sometimes, he said, you know what, I don't know why you don't write on the back label of wine the experience that I need to get, you know, drinking this wine. So why don't you sit there, instead of explaining the Sauvignon Blanc, you explain where I'm sitting on the beach under an umbrella and having this glass of wine, because that people will get. And I thought, this is such a valid point. It's not always about education. So coming back, I always drift off the idea. If you want to be educated about wine, first start drinking it. Don't drink what your friend tells you you should drink. Drink what you enjoy. So if you start drinking wine and you prefer something that's slightly sweeter, start with that. Build up enough knowledge about the different sweet wines that you're going to get until you feel like, okay, let's now try something that's slightly drier, and take it step by step. Don't just jump into that 400 rand bottle of wine, for that matter, that you probably should age 15 years before you get it. Because if you don't have any idea of what to expect in wines with tannins or that is made to age, you are going to be put off. It's like if you fit or unfit, you're not going to jump in and dry cycle the first day you cycle 100 kilometers. You're going to start and maybe do 5, and you're going to build it up to 100. Wine is, in a way, pretty much the same. Drink what you enjoy, then move on to the next thing. Once you've built up a knowledge, you move to the next step. Once you're there, you move to the next step. And then you ask, you start asking more technical questions and start understanding it.
What is something that people experience or taste when they drink South African wine?
Sunshine in a bottle.
Sunshine in a bottle? That sounds perfect to me.
Something like that. We've got a lot of sun. We've got lots of fruit. It's our job as winemakers to balance, like if you make more serious wines that's been in wood, is to not overwood your wines. You know, it's what I obviously try and do. That
overwood means?
People sometimes think that if you can smell and taste wood being from the barrels in a wine, it's a better wine than the other one. My philosophy is actually completely the opposite. That if you make a wine and the wine is not strong enough to be able to handle the wood, you should never put it in the wood, because wine is a fruit. So the first impression should be fruit. Wood is an added thing that you put for a different purpose. If it's starting to overpower, you've made a mistake. So fruit is the first key, and some of my wines go to 70% new oak in the reds, or my one white wine goes to 50% new oak. But if you smell that wine, the first thing you're going to smell is going to be orange blossoms and honey and those kind of flavors, because the concentration of the juice from the first day was already so much that it would just absorb that. And then the oak would just add that kind of a roundness and creaminess to the wine that makes it exceptional.
So before we go into the last segment, which are five questions I'm going to ask you at the end of it, I want to ask you about one thing. Is that I heard you speak about the values that you portray as well, the values that you live by, and you mentioned something like honesty and loyalty. Where are those values rooted, and why did you pick those as an answer? How do you think about living working in a vineyard carried by values and a sense of mission as well?
Well, you want to know, like, how do I portray the values that how I feel?
Why did you pick honesty and loyalty as your? Yeah, why do you connect with those values?
Well, simple answer on honesty is that if you're going to talk the truth or say something as it is, you're going to tell somebody, especially if you come from the marketing side of it as well, you're always going to tell a person the right story. As soon as you're not going to, if you're going to start making a story out of something and you go from one event to the other, you're going to have to remember, what did I tell somebody there? And I'm telling the different story here. And you're never going to know when somebody connects the two and maybe phones you and say, like, but you said this here and now it's that. And now what is the right story? So that's probably why I say honesty. And the joke side of us is that, you know, 20 years ago, I could remember very well. And I even had the philosophy then. But nowadays, I don't remember that well anymore. You know, going over a certain age, your brain goes a bit more porridge. So now it's really important. Because if I would tell different stories, I wouldn't remember what I've told. But if I told the right story, the truth, and I was honest about really what I'm doing, I'm always going to say that. I'm never going to have to think what I do. And what I do and what I then tell people is really going to come from the heart, because that's how I feel about my wines. They're part of me. And that's why honesty is really important for me. And it's not just about the story that you tell about wine. It's like, what is your life about? If your life is honest, it's easy. If your life is not honest, it gets complicated. Loyalty, you probably need to be loyal in yourself and your beliefs. You need to be, if you want to be a winemaker, be loyal. You know, don't just seek the money and the fame and all of those behind it. Seek about that achievement and what that spot is about. That's being loyal towards something. And I mean, my hardest things are really, if you want to make a career change, is to make the career change, because I feel still loyal towards where I've started. You know, whatever steps you make in life with different jobs, even if you're an accountant, somewhere you only could move on and be successful because of stuff that you achieved and somebody that invested in you. So you need to stay, I believe, for the rest of your life, loyal to the person that gave you the opportunity in the first place. And one day, you know, it comes back and you can give back in a much better way.
So when you look back at those 25 years of making wines, what is your favorite lesson that you learned along the way?
Favorite lesson? I guess it's to, and it can be disappointing somebody, but it's to believe in people's enthusiasm and that they're honest in what they want to achieve and that they want to be successful. It's probably that. You know, I can't now think of something else, but lessons, again, coming back to the loyalty and honesty, you know, if that's your beliefs, I guess if I didn't think that way and I made a mistake, then I had to learn a lesson through that. But if I've always believed, like, to be honest, it's made me to achieve things in my life that's actually, I didn't have to work for it. It just came naturally.
Cool. We're moving into the last segment and then we'll have to let you go. It's a series of five short questions and answers to close off this interview. The first one would be, if you could leave people with a piece of advice that they can put into action right away from something we've discussed today, what would you tell them?
I would suggest anybody that goes into a career is to make a decision for something that you like to do, because then you're going to be happy. Your career also needs to make you happy. You can't just be happy if you go home at night. You know, it needs to be part of your everyday life. You're going to spend most of your hours doing something. You might as well do something that you love. And yeah, so that's basically answering your question.
If you would think about, we talked a lot about the skills needed in the process of making wine and how to acquire those skills. If you would think about three skills that are perhaps more foundational for people, that people should develop earlier in their career, but that can also be ported throughout different phases of the career or even different lines of work, what would those three skills be?
So probably in anything that you do is to, from an early age in your life, is to learn to be friendly towards people. Friendly people always attracts other people. Everybody always wants to be the girl that's always laughing or the guy that's always laughing, best friend. Enthusiasm. You know, if you've got enthusiasm, even if you suddenly hit a wall, you're going to make a plan to get over it and take the next challenge on. And be goal-orientated. You know, set yourself a target to achieve. Everybody can't always achieve. You have different personalities. But, you know, goals doesn't always have to be the best in something. A goal can also be to just be able to make somebody else happy, for that matter. But it is good to have a purpose where you are working towards.
So being friendly, having enthusiasm, and having some sense of goals and goal
setting.
Exactly. Great. Do you have an item on your bucket list that you still would like to check off?
Yeah, I mean, I would, it's going to sound funny, and I would actually still like to do the hike up to Machu Picchu in Peru.
Yeah.
You know, I just love beautiful nature things. And I mean, that might not be the only one that I maybe still once in my life would like to see. I mean, it can be the Great Wall of China, and it's kind of stuff that nature's given us. I would like to see stuff like that, definitely.
Yeah, those are definitely two that I haven't done as well. So I'll steal them for my list as well. What do you think is an experience that, and I'm keeping experience broadly defined as possible, what is an experience that everybody did, or that people should at least have made in their life, made once in their life?
Experience. I don't think I've thought about this one enough. I think you need to I think you need to go out and experience good things in life, you know, and stop always thinking of, am I going to afford this? You know, sometimes you just need to plunge out there and just have something earthly in that way, probably. So if it is buying a fun car, you know, you don't really need that 1948 Porsche, but it's coming your way, and experience the good out of it, you know, and make a memory, because that stays with you forever. I think in today's life, it's so much about everything is so fast that we actually forget to enjoy life, and we should just really live in the moment and enjoy where we are now.
Do you think, and it's maybe a sidestep, is do you think that living or being on in a vineyard like this, which is a beautiful setting, do you think it helps you slow down as well? Or is the nature of your job one that still creeps in and wants to accelerate your life again?
Yeah, as much as people think harvest is such a tough time of the year, it is probably my most relaxing time of the year. I mean, besides that, I get so excited about it still, and I have a new idea that I want to try this year. It is the time of the year where people don't bother me about the other side of the business. They leave me to make wine. So I really enjoy this. To me, it's relaxing. And yes, to be able, again, coming back to the first one I answered, is, you know, if choose things, choose a career that you know you're going to really enjoy. It's part of your life. So my job doesn't feel like a job. It's how my day is about every year. The frustrating parts in my job is that the parts that's not related with winemaking, but the part of being able to walk in the vineyards and be in the cellar and taste out of the barrel and making that decision of bottling, that is life. You know, that's what it's about.
My final question for you today is, and it's a question we ask everybody on the podcast, but also in the local events that we host in Berlin, where I live, is what advice would you give your 14-year-old self? And I think that's the interesting piece, because you mentioned this at the beginning, that so that's a question we ask everybody, which you didn't know. And then you asked me the question, is that did I pick that age, 14, because on purpose, because that's when you decided to become a winemaker. So maybe that's the perfect question for you.
Yeah, it's written in many things that you probably could have picked up through Google on me. That's basically when. So that's why I asked the question. Yeah. So if I have to look back at myself and having decided already at that age what I want to do with my life, and going back, I probably would have told myself to work harder in high school. You know, as much as you think you worked hard and your grades were good, they could have been better, because by the time you get to university, the workload is so much more. And we all think we've got so much work in school, but it's actually a fraction of what's lying ahead. So any 14-year-old, high school is a blast. And if you can work a bit harder and maybe get a bursary and have an opportunity to go and study at an even better university and get yourself better educated, it's worth it to do that.
Really great. We're at the Haskell Vineyards with Riani Stridham, who's the winemaker and general manager here. Thank you so much for taking the time. I think, and I want to thank you as well for making wines. You know, you said that wine is one of the good things in life, and I agree. So thank you for, you know, putting your version of wines into this world. Thank you for taking the time, for sharing so openly as well. And I can't wait to try your wines and maybe bring back a bottle or two as well.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you so much.
No, thanks for the opportunity. I have to thank you. As I said, I asked, how did you get hold of us? And it's nice to know that my name still comes up as one of South Africa's leading women winemakers. It's really a privilege.
Great. And by the way, if you're still listening to this, Riani has two jobs open now, looking for an assistant winemaker and a marketing genius so that she can learn from. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Riani.
Cool. Bye.
If you liked this episode, then why not check out one of the previous episodes of the Role Models podcast? We have had conversations with people like Cindy Gallup, who is a former advertising executive turned entrepreneur and a vocal advocate for more diversity in business. Or maybe Cindy Holland, who is the vice president of original content at Netflix, and where she talks about being a leader in a company that she's been with for almost 15 years. Or maybe chef and author Samin Nosrat, who just released a book about how to learn the fundamentals of cooking, and where she shares the story about how she just walked up to a restaurant carrying a letter and then left that restaurant with having a job. If you like to support Role Models because you like it, then please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. And then please also post a really quick review about what you think, what you like about the show, and maybe even while you're at it, click on the 5-star rating. This really helps the Role Models podcast reach people like you, and also helps the stories of our role models reach more people. If you have any feedback for us, reach out on Twitter. We're at Role Models. And if you have any feedback for me, you can reach me also on Twitter by tweeting at David. Thank you for listening. Until next time.